and it was an immense pleasure to catch up with Nikos Karidis for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Nikos is senior lecturer in architecture and planning at the University of Kent, and we talk about the way architecture is represented in movies, why they present alternative architect lives to what happens in the real world. Nikos grew up in Athens before moving to the UK. We find out what attracted him to architecture in the mid-1990s via furniture design. His field is architectural history and the architecture of churches. We talk about the journey of discovery, how Nikos could never have anticipated the final destination. We talk about the role of serendipity in shaping us. And we talk about the way limitations can sometimes generate great creativity and why improvisation is essential. We discuss classical music, especially the piano, and Nikos and I both have a twin passion for cinema and radio. Nikos talks about music in Kubrick cinema and the use of contrasts and counterpoints. We talk about how cinema was very specific in Greece when Nikos was growing up. Cinema was a window to the world like no other. He talks about how he perceives Greece now and his childhood in the days since the internet. We discuss pilgrimage and the pursuit of knowledge. It's not just the holy relic of the destination, but the ritual and the path there. We learn about Nikos's passion for Radio 3, how we can travel in time through those radio broadcasts, and we learn that Nikos is an optimist, how our response to adversity can be positive. We learn how Nikos couldn't imagine having followed a different pathway. We discuss accident and our response to it in relation to North by Northwest. Would we both like to be Roger Thornhill? And we find out about the recapturing of lost dreams and lost worlds and lost buildings that play a key role in Nikos's life. It was an immense pleasure to catch up with Nikos for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure this week to have Nikos Karidis from architecture here at the University of Kent. And we haven't really had a chance to talk in great detail, have we, Nikos, about some of the twin passions, cinema and radio, that, as we were both discussing, have very much sort of informed our own belief systems and worldviews.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, delighted to be with you, Chris. Thank you for this lovely invitation. I'm very honoured. And yeah, look forward to exploring this common passion of ours. Yeah.
And the one thing, whenever I do see you, Nikos, I'm always struck that so many films, my favourite films from the 90s, often they always seem to have Richard Gere in them, have architects as the employment of the white male protagonist. You know, Richard Gere, I think, Intersection comes to mind. And so we, I think, through Facebook, sort of got into a conversation about all these architecture-themed, particularly 90s thrillers. Yes. So is that something that you've been aware of?
Yes, actually, I love cinema, but I must say, I was thinking about this because of our discussions, I've never found myself questioning the way architecture is represented in movies. And of course, I had some thought about this prior to this interview, and I was trying to see which films actually might go close to actually representing what I've experienced as an architect, or something close to it, or the realities of the profession. And I was thinking that perhaps either my understanding of architectural filmic roles is limited, or I don't know, maybe it is a profession that is not very well represented in film. I haven't found a very realistic cinematic portrait of an architect yet. There are two that come to mind. I think the most striking for me was the leading role in the film The Fountainhead, which is the 50s classic with, I think, is it Gary Cooper, I think, which with this idealistic modernist architect. And then a comedy again in the 50s. I think it's called Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House with Cary Grant. I think especially the second one went actually remarkably close to actually showing, communicating some things that a practitioner encounters on a daily basis. But it did so in a very entertaining manner. So this was very good. But on other occasions, I just saw someone being an architect without the specific conditions of this profession being exploited in the script.
And you're right, because I find that when in films somebody who's a religious studies professor or a theologian is portrayed, it never matches the actuality. Normally in a film, if you've got somebody who has that particular academic role, then they're somebody of belief. And I always think there was a Denzel Washington film called Fallen that came out in the late 1990s. And so he goes to such a figure in a university. He says, "Do you believe in God, Mr. Hobbes?" And I was thinking, imagine if I did that with my student. You know, I think people would probably be rather mystified. So it must be the same with architects in that respect.
Perhaps it is the mission of a cinema to idealize. It's not a record of what an architect does. Perhaps that's too boring for a film. Perhaps the cinema needs to explore an alternative kind of an architect. So I think it's legitimate that they change things in the same way, for instance, that Indiana Jones can never be an archaeologist, isn't it? This is something very different. So archaeology serves as a point of departure, and then you create a mythical world on this basis. So on one hand, it's legitimate, but on the other hand, I think there is a missed opportunity because I think the same applies to painters. I think we haven't seen sufficient good films about painters, I feel. The one that went very close was The Girl with the Pearl Earring. And I think the key there is they found in Vermeer, in the paintings of Vermeer, an opportunity to talk about the context, the period. And they used painting as a means of unlocking all sorts of messages that really help you. They transport you back to 17th century Low Countries, the Netherlands. Delft, I think, is the place. So I think architecture has the same potential and is yet to be exploited, perhaps.
Well, I think you're right, because it's the springboard, isn't it? Because you can watch a film and we can laugh sometimes and think, this is completely unrealistic. I think Barbara Streisand playing an English professor in The Mirror Has Two Faces. Yes. And that's just so funny because, you know, she goes so, in a way, off script, but that would never happen. But then I think, but if it did, all the better for it. So I kind of like, it's the template. It's like, this is not the way people really behave in this profession. But sometimes caricatures are really good because they help you deal with that dissonance between how things perhaps are perceived as and how things are. And then that creates a conversation like, you know, we know our professions from the inside. Yeah. But from the outside, I suppose people sometimes do perhaps put us on pedestals, or they imagine we do things that we don't do. Yes. But actually that, in a way, takes us on an interesting journey. Yeah. Sort of, well, you know, let's you know, maybe that's where people's passions come from. Exactly. You know, and sometimes if people imagine that we're doing things that we're not even remotely doing, well, like with Indiana Jones, sometimes it gives us a certain sort of luster. People think, God, you must do some magnificent things in your profession. And you think, well, yes, we do. Because we don't want to say, yes, it's all sort of, you know, it's all about module specifications. Exactly. Which often, of course, it is.
Or statistics on pottery profiles. Yeah. You wouldn't
absolutely
do that, would you?
Yeah. But we should say something about your background, really, because obviously, am I right in thinking that you grew up in Greece?
Greece, in Athens, that's right, until I was 23. And then I moved to the UK, first to London and then to Bath. Yeah. And I've remained ever since with an interruption, which is two years in Rome, in Italy.
Was architecture something that you always wanted to go into?
I remember that I had a passion for making things and obviously drawing and expressing myself through drawing. So I suspect that that set the foundations for my interest in architecture. But I think that what really attracted me to architecture was in the mid-90s, a passion for industrial design and furniture. And this gave me access to all those great furniture designers / architects of the 20th century, early 20th century, the modernists, like Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, etc. People who know me will find that this is a bit strange, because now I am actually investigating a different kind of architecture. But that was the entrance into the world of architecture, through the work of those architects who sought to expand the scope of architectural design in order to encompass also industrial design and furniture. And it was, I think this must have been when I was a teenager. And it's through the works of these architects exploring this work that I developed a passion for architecture, but that very soon changed during my studies, and I started exploring the history of architecture and becoming more and more passionate about the architecture before modernism, and in fact, buildings and spaces that those modernist architects would not have liked or would like to supersede with new designs. So I started finding more and more value in the architecture of the past. And that, I think, led me to develop this interest in architectural history, which is now my primary research field, and specifically religious architecture, so the architecture of churches. My doctoral research has looked at the form of the first vaulted churches in Asia Minor.
Do you know, I was just thinking, everybody in this profession is on a journey of some sort, and I suppose it's easy, and not least because of my interest in nostalgia, I suppose hindsight obviously plays a central role. But it's so easy to look back and see all these threads, all these patterns. But I'm also interested in returning to that, you know, 5 or 15-year-old self and imagining how that younger version of oneself could possibly imagine, you know, how they would feel about the journey that one ends up taking. And does that work for you? Because it sounds as though there's a very clear sort of synthesis there. There's almost a sense that everything is sort of coming together. Yeah. But I'm very interested that you're clearly doing something now about which you're passionate. But do you think that's something that you kind of knew from a younger age, that this might be a direction that you could possibly go down?
Not at all. I think it has been a constant improvisation that has seen many turns, twists and turns along the way. It was a journey of discovery. I could never, I think, have anticipated the final destination. Perhaps one can, looking back, one can see some rationale determining this path. Perhaps some basic interests, for instance, in making things and producing things that underpins everything I do. Otherwise, I think that the conditions at the time very much played a role in actually shaping this pathway that I've followed. And it's in response to events, to people that I've encountered, to opportunities that arose that where I had no active role in shaping. So it's in response to these that I actually chose one path versus another.
Yeah, and I've actually found that even over the last few days, because I'm on study leave this semester, and in my mind I'm sometimes thinking, okay, I've got X number of weeks and I want to write a certain amount by Christmas and so on. But when I actually start writing, it doesn't go in anything like the direction I imagined it would. And sometimes I think, right, I've got 2 days to work on this section and 3 days the other. And I'm writing, I'm thinking, it's got a momentum of itself. And it's sometimes funny how you've got all the resources. And you know how sometimes people say, I've got a thesis in my head or a book in my head. But until you actually commit it to paper or to your computer, you never quite know. And that's the exciting bit. So even though sometimes we kind of know what our projects are, you never quite know even what sort of conclusion you might draw. Because, as you say, it's based on all the different interpretations and the different sources that you come across en route that shape you on that journey.
Accidents, fortune, you know, serendipity, all these play an enormous role. And if one went back to cinema, I think if one was wondering, you know, about films that show this really well, I think they're Woody Allen is the master of that, especially the controversial later phase. I think especially Matchpoint shows the role of accident and luck in shaping one's life in a way. And before him, I think George Roy Hill showed the comic aspect. Many will know George Roy Hill as the wonderful director of The Sting and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But again, his later phase, I think A Little Romance, is full of little accidents that have a key role in shaping someone's pathway in life.
And I think that's why, like, the Richard Curtis rom-coms are so enjoyed by people, because it's that you've got often, back to what we were saying earlier, the reinforcement sometimes of certain ideas of what people are like. And it plays on them, caricatures them, but also puts them in interaction with somebody from a completely different, maybe a different class system or different background, and then shows how the two of them are shaped. And that kind of, I think, is representative of so many of our lives. It's those chance, maybe serendipitous encounters, and sometimes, of course, it may not be. We look back and think, oh, actually, that wasn't a very fortunate happening. You know, maybe I shouldn't have met that person and so on. But then, of course, for the rest of your life, you can't not interpret relationships, colleagues, even the research that we're doing, except through the lens of what has shaped us up to that point. And sometimes, maybe, I always feel that, you know, sometimes we were often maybe even destined to repeat some of the mistakes, yes, of the past. And, you know, that's a human foible. But it is also very telling sometimes when we have an opportunity sometimes to say, okay, well, I was in this position once before. What are the lessons learned? Let me apply those lessons to this new project.
Exactly. Yes, yes. I think it's very often we idealize all everything that shapes or limits the possibilities in our lives as fate, no? We say, oh, it's just... And sometimes life can appear to be a struggle between, you know, personal will and then individual's desires and fate, or what we call fate, which in fact can be, you know, the conditions around us, the limitations, etc., that push us towards one direction or another. Political events can actually shape that. We see that as we speak. And I think that these competing forces sometimes can generate wonderful things. One's awareness of those limitations can actually encourage incredible creativity.
I was just thinking, because when I got the email to say that my study leave had been approved, yeah, it was on the 8th of September, the day the Queen died. Yeah. Oh. And so, and that's a project that I've been working on, sort of looking at the way, yeah, particularly BBC Radio, yeah, has dealt with, you know, covered the, yes, the aftermath of the death of the Queen. Yes. And what was really interesting is that it's all littered with our new Prime Minister, Liz Truss. And of course, all these sort of almost like jokes about the end of one Elizabethan reign and the beginning of, you know, in terms of short, Prime Minister, another one, although one 70 years versus a matter of weeks. Yes. So, and it's just very funny looking back, all these references to a new Prime Minister, mm-hmm, and we look at what's happened in, you know, so since I've been on study leave, you know, the political system, our constitution almost has sort of been completely sort of thrown, yes, in the air, yeah, and I also think that sometimes we all need perspective, we need to step back, yeah, but sometimes just on a day-to-day basis, the thrill almost, it is like, actually sometimes it's like watching a good movie, yeah, but sometimes it's the unknown, yeah, and what that does to us, because I think we all need our systems. I come into work, even on study leave, I'm in every day, and I need my lattes, yes, and I think we were talking about hot chocolates and certain designated times, I'm sure we'll come on to that. All these things that we feel that the urge to do, yeah, and yet sometimes we set ourselves up in relation to these forces where we have little control. I mean, Brexit is a very obvious one that, you know, it's very, unless you're a very senior person in government, it's unlikely that you're going to always be able to shape the currents of the age. No matter what you think about it, you can go on a protest, you can write a great treatise, you can protest and do all sorts of things. But ultimately, you're just a cog in the wheel. Mm-hmm. And I find that sometimes, you know, even on a project, when you devise the project, and then actually write it, there's no way you could possibly anticipate the different forces that could, yeah, intervene in that intervening period. It must be the same for you.
It's exactly the same. And improvisation, yeah, I think, is essential. It's I think that only machines can be programmed to work according to a pre-described pattern, isn't it? And I think that we, by definition, improvise, because our mind gives us this incredible dynamic ability to shape things as they come along. So I'm a great believer in improvisation and adjusting to circumstances as they arise. And I think also that it is it's something to be celebrated, improvisation. And sometimes, even if you have rigorously planned something, adding some improvisation to it. And I think we were discussing about how we prepare for lectures, and we were saying that you might actually write down a lecture, but it would be good to go off script at some point, and that makes it so much more lively. And I think this is very true for another passion of mine, which is classical music, and in particular, I love the piano. So in piano playing, of course, most of the musical literature is written, and you have the sheet music, and the creative exercise consists in actually interpreting what has been written on paper. And I always found that the best interpretations were the ones that made you feel that the pianist is not actually playing again a piece that has been played for centuries sometimes, but they're making it up. And they make it sound so natural and improvised, even though it has been written with very specific indications and instructions.
Yeah, and I think sometimes there's that interplay that going to concerts or gigs can sometimes represent, where there might be a piece of music, maybe from childhood, a record that one bought when one was young. And I feel conflicted sometimes because the obvious follow-through would be to go in and see that artist performing on stage. But, of course, when they're performing on stage, it's always going to sound and obviously look different from that particular, you know, the version that was committed to vinyl all those decades earlier. And I find that I always sort of like the original, but I like the original in new context, like on the radio.
Yes.
So it's not just listening to it on that one, on the record player, on the CD or whatever, but actually listening to it in that format, but played on a live radio program with people then interacting with it and saying, gosh, this takes me back to 1981 or whatever it might be. And I find that interesting. So there are particular things that, you know, I surprise myself sometimes at how the obvious follow on for something that is of interest of mine isn't the one that actually I take. You know, I love, we'll come on to radio in a minute, but cinema is a big love of mine, but radio is probably an even bigger love. And it's interesting that sometimes these worlds don't always cross over brilliantly, but I suppose I have that sort of vantage point of how these are my twin interests, and perhaps they're more my twin interests than they are for most other people who might be, you know, interested in one but not so much the other.
I must say I have exactly the same passion for both cinema and radio and music. I exactly get what you mean, that when a piece of music is even something, you know, a record or a CD that we've heard countless times, is curated in a way, it's put in a context which actually changes completely its message. I think it's the same, because you mentioned cinema, it's exactly the same when you find a favorite piece of music as the musical background, as the soundtrack to a film. It is transformed. I don't remember what this... my memory with films, I've seen so many that my memory fails me very often. But there is that film. I think Sean Penn is the director, if not the director, at least he's a star. And there is this slow movement from Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto in one of the most dramatic scenes. It's a very slow movement. And this for me, the use of this music in this film completely unlocked the meaning of this of this particular piece, and I don't think I would have been able to actually understand it so deeply, and if it wasn't for that use, from this curation, no one had thought of putting it in the context of the situation that the film communicated. And I think the same holds for, we spoke earlier about Stanley Kubrick, and he was a master in actually, I don't think he worked with many, perhaps I'm wrong, most of the time I think he used existing pieces of music, classical music, into his films. 2001: A Space Odyssey is a typical example. And then the music developed a new meaning. For instance, I don't know if anyone, Khachaturian's piece, for instance, I think is the Adagio, he has written for one of his ballets. But listening to it as an accompaniment of a scene that takes place in space gave the music in a completely new colors and the possibilities for interpretation. So absolutely, the way in which you curate and the context within which you enjoy, I think, any work of art alters and plays a role in our perception of it, in our appreciation.
Do you know, you've just made me think. I completely agree with everything you've just said. I saw Bergman's Island a few months ago, an independent film with Tim Roth. And it's based around some aficionados, some fans of Ingmar Bergman, who go to the place where he was, where he grew up, and sort of immerse themselves in the culture, and in some cases actually perhaps see things or learn things about him that, you know, they're fans of his movies, but maybe a slightly more questionable personal life. Yes. So there's some interesting background materials about he had lots of children, but was so busy with his films he didn't spend time with them. But then there's one point in the film, and I think Tim Roth is there, and I think he's with his partner, and he's the big fan, and she isn't, and they sort of go off on sort of, you know, one of them wants to follow the official tour, the other one goes, shall we say, AWOL.
Yes.
But as I recall, and this was a few months since I saw it, but there's one point in the film when, you know, you've got all this stuff about Bergman, all very highbrow and all very serious intellectual, you know, European cinema.
Yeah.
And then suddenly in the soundtrack appears, and it might not be this, but it's either ABBA or I think Baccarat, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie.
Yeah.
And this appears, and it seems so inappropriate.
Yeah. Yes.
But also so perfect at the same time because of the counterpoint.
It's interesting.
And it worked really well. But on, I think it was maybe in the trailer. And I was just really quite struck by the way that this didn't seem to belong in the film. So that almost gave me the incentive to follow it through.
It's all about contrasts and counterpoint. Back to Kubrick, Clockwork Orange, the use of the American musical of the 50s, you know, Singing in the Rain. I think no one would have ever imagined that it could be actually form part of the gruesome context it's inserted in. And that's a very intriguing film that you mentioned. I'm, of course, a great fan of Ingmar Bergman. It's actually, most people discover Bergman later on. I think through his... when he was actually making his films for television in the 80s, late 80s, I was actually discovering, that gave me the opportunity to discover his work through Fanny and Alexander. And that was, I remember it had a huge impact on me because the way he filmed, the world he portrayed, had some dreamy character that astonished me at the time. And I still remember my surprise at being exposed to this.
And with a really good film, I guess it can apply to music as well, it's that you see yourself in different sort of points, different iterations of oneself at different periods in one's life in relation to that film.
Yes.
And I'm often taken back maybe to the first viewing of the film, maybe at university, maybe even from childhood. And then that you take a little bit of that with you. And the film also seems to be a barometer as well. It's like holding out a mirror to yourself.
To yourself. It's a Dorian Gray picture in a way. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And with this particular film, since we mentioned it, I found that I was actually surprised that some elements of it did not seem to have shocked me particularly as a child, whereas now I found them quite terrifying. Actually, you would expect the opposite to happen, but in my case, I found it more terrifying now for some strange reason, and certainly not a film for a younger person. I think that it unlocks its secrets, but it seems that there were aspects of the atmosphere that it was showing that I could perceive better, perhaps as a child. But some of this magic I felt was lost now in the second viewing because I watched it a few months ago. I remember,
and I find with A Clockwork Orange.
Oh yes.
That film was banned by Kubrick himself for many years. And I saw it at university. It's probably okay to mention this now.
It was illegal, wasn't it, after it came out? Yes.
And they showed it at my university in 1992.
Yes.
And I probably had never heard of Kubrick at that point, and certainly not much about the film. But it was a sort of, everyone was like, oh, I can't believe they're showing this. You must come along.
Yes.
So we had this huge audience. Yeah. I think everyone went to see it because it was the seal of first. But it was a very disturbing film.
Very.
And I've seen it since. And I actually saw it only a year ago at one of the multiplexes in Kent, in Dover. I was the only one in there. It was very, it was a very, very surreal experience to have first watched it in this big audience at the age of 18, and then to see it in my late 40s and be the only person seeing it on the large screen in the cinema. And sort of to chart it through. But you're right, it's never lost its capacity to horrify. And I'm not actually sure whether I like it or not. I'm still drawn to it, but it's a film that gives me some, which I suppose is also the reason why it stands the test of time in a way, exactly. Because it's at the very least, it's certainly not a film to which you could ever be indifferent.
No, exactly. I remember what a shock it was when I first watched it, but it's certainly not one that I could watch again, I feel. But it was a great shock. And in general, with Kubrick, what a great film director. But again, I found that I've demystified him, his art, or that I've perhaps grown a little bit more distant from him. I think the revelation to me about a negative revelation about Kubrick was when I first watched Barry Lyndon, and then years later I read Thackeray's work. And then I realized that for all the wonderful atmosphere that Kubrick creates and his reproduction of the interiors, the manners, the mannerisms of the 18th century, I felt that there was so much in Thackeray's novel that actually was lost in translation. And perhaps the best parts were left out, in my view, especially the Hogarthian social criticism that is embedded in Thackeray's work, and the satire, I felt was not... I don't think that the film did justice to this specific aspect. I think, funnily enough, much more modest endeavours, for instance, television films of Thackeray's, I think carried out by Andrew Davis for the BBC, have captured this character and these messages, I think, much more faithfully. But then, you know, we go back to the question, what is the mission of cinema? Is it just to reproduce the effect of the novel, or just to use the model as a vehicle to express something else? And I think in the case of Kubrick, what is stunning is not so much the messages of the script, but the artistry in recreating a lost world or creating dreams that are extremely vivid when you watch them. And I think that is why it's not only the violent scenes that we're perhaps thinking of in the case of The Clockwork Orange, but it's the vividness and the artistry with which this atmosphere, this world is created.
Yeah, he's very good at conjuring up these... Exactly. I mean, even with his Stephen King adaptation, I don't think Stephen King was very keen on The Shining. Yeah. And of course, he did it in his own very bespoke way. But there, I mean, I think with Kubrick, he was famous for those multiple shots, you know, he multiple takes, you know. Well, I think there was one in The Shining, it was like 60 or 70. I think Jack Nicholson had to intervene and say, stop, this is too much. But also there was something very clinical, I think, about Kubrick. And you kind of feel almost as though he kind of knew what he wanted to do. But in a way, it's breathtaking cinema. But maybe it lacks feeling, it lacks heart, it lacks empathy.
You might say so, yes. This school of actually micromanaging every single detail of the movie, of course, goes far back. I think it was to the beginnings of the cinema, directors like Fritz Lang, to mention one director who has remained a favorite and stands the test of time. I think they would hire architects for advice on the sets and how, you know, you create an interior, how you represent a city. But at the same time, they would make copious notes about where the actors are going to stand, etc. So you had this, it's an element of the craftsmanship of making movies, associated perhaps to the limitations of the technology at the time, which perhaps the modern generation with handheld cameras has actually superseded. However, I think that there is, even though that might threaten, as you say, to suck the life out of the movie, at the same time it gives us an incredible artistic control and has created, I think, masterpieces. The choreography of certain scenes that you see in 50s films and the way in which the actors are actually instructed to speak or to act, I think has created wonderful works of art.
And when you were growing up in Athens, did cinema play a big role then? You mentioned Fritz Lang and even perhaps Kubrick, but did the enjoyment of cinema sort of go back to a young age?
Absolutely. I think that I would never have this love for cinema if I was born and if I had grown up somewhere else. Cinema is very particular in Athens. I think that because Greece at the time was not so well connected because of its geographical location with the creative centers, or what were perceived to be the creative centers. I don't want to exclude other areas, but what were perceived to be the creative centers, the most active creative centers of the time, namely, you know, Central Europe. I think that the cinema was a way, a window to the world like no other. Before the time of internet, certainly, it was the only way you had to experience how life is further away. So Athens was blessed with wonderful cinemas that were, as buildings, they were usually very, you know, very large and ostentatious. And going to the cinema was a very important social event. It was very often to have queues outside the cinema, and actually queuing, waiting for to watch a film was part of the experience. So there was a kind of a ritual going to the cinema for during the weekend. And it's the funny thing is that the cinema also adapted to the climate in an interesting way. For instance, in winter, you would have, of course, these huge cinema halls that in many cases were converted former theatres or opera houses. So they were incredibly ornate and magical in their interiors. So the magic started before the film was projected on screen, actually being in the hall. Such huge, you know, halls with so many other people created a unique atmosphere. But in the summer, something magical happens because it's too hot to be indoors and a bit unpleasant. We have this tradition of open-air cinemas. And then there are specific cinemas that are obviously in open-air. And there you see, you watch films in a slightly more informal setting. But nature, the rain, the landscape around you plays a role in the film. I remember, for instance, wonderful film scenes being projected in the screen, and the background being the apartment blocks of Athens, the neighboring buildings, or indeed there is a particular cinema where you can watch a film and see the Acropolis in the background and, you know, the rising moon, which makes, you know, all this experience of a film even more magical. So I think that these conditions made movies a great part not only of my entertainment as I was growing up, but also a great part of my education. The other fortunate aspect was that the cinema entrepreneurs in Greece were very open to different kinds of cinema. So world cinema was much more represented than it is currently here. For instance, in the UK, even now, you get a decent exposure to cinematic production beyond that of the UK and the United States, only if you live in a big urban center like London. Perhaps there are other occasions, but many parts of the countries have a very limited exposure to what is being produced, let's say, in France or in the Middle East or in the Far East, in China, Japan, etc. But Athens was late 90s, was extremely cosmopolitan. You could see films from Jean Guimou regularly at the time when one of his films was banned in China. So actually viewing it was a political event. But you could also watch a lot of French movies, German cinema. I have a very fond memory of watching films from Iran, Turkey. And that made this silver screen a window to our world like no other. Mm.
And you just made me think, actually, you mentioned open-air cinema, but I'm quite partial to some, but not all of the Bond films. But in the late 90s, I saw one of the Pierce Brosnan ones, and it was maybe The World Is Not Enough.
Yes.
And the Millennium Dome, as it was then called, had only just been built. And there's a scene where he injures his leg and he's sort of scaling down, he's sort of skiing or something like that, I don't know, down the building. Anyway, so that scene sort of stuck in my mind. But then I saw the film just a few months ago at the O2, which was the Millennium Dome, because they were showing all the Bond films. And it was in the summer, and I drove up to London and thought, you know, I'll watch this film. Yes. And a bit nostalgia for me, because it was the late 90s. Yes. And I thought, well, I saw this film first time around. I had my notes, had my diary from the pier, and I wanted to sort of go back and see it again. Really? But I wasn't, and I hadn't seen the film in the intervening years. So there's me sitting in the O2. And then there he is on the O2, at the O2, scaling down the very building. And it was almost as though, and I was like joking about this afterwards when I was telling people, but it was almost as though I sort of like came out the cinema afterwards. It was like I wanted to just look out to make sure, is he okay? but the serious point to that is that you're watching a film in an environment where that environment is indelibly linked to your apprehension of the film. And I mean, were there particular, you mentioned a few of the ones that you saw in the 90s in Greece, but have there been films that you've watched since and it's impossible to shake that original apprehension?
Absolutely. In the particular strand of films in particular, I used to be a regular visitor of the Museum of Cinema of Athens, where you watch films in a very, very special conditions. The Museum of Cinema was an old neoclassical building, I think a large residence, and this projection hall was a small room for a cinema, but which used to be, I think, an old living room. It had a very select audience of film buffs, and it showed almost exclusively historic films, mostly free films ranging from the 30s to the 60s. My first exposure to the Italian neorealist movement of the 50s, you know, Roberto Rossellini, Vittorio De Sica, etc., etc., was through this screen. And I remember in particular the fact that because the film reels they used were the original ones. So it was, the museum had copies of these films from when they came to Athens. These were not restored copies. The film were occasionally, it was highly flammable, of course, and would occasionally burn. And you would see the screen disappearing during the height of the action. And then an interval had to take place for the film to be repaired before starting again. Sadly, this building actually burnt down. And I wonder if the causes of the fire was actually one of those accidents I had witnessed. So these were just very romantic, very particular conditions. And they have added, let's say, a luster to those films. And always the memory of this this whole, this museum building always comes back to me when I watch the films again.
And of course, here you are now as an academic in England, in the University of Kent. I mean, when you look back growing up in Greece, are you aware, obviously there's the time difference, because obviously you're looking at different decades in between, but does it feel like a distant land? I'm sure you go back to Greece often, but does it feel quite sort of incongruous to the world that you're living in now? Do you look back through an idyllic sort of lens to your childhood growing
obviously,
up in Greece?
Yes. It's highly, I'm sure I idealize it, because I'm extremely fond of it, and it's full of pleasant memories. Especially from Athens and my experiences there. I think it is, funnily, it's not only Greece that is distant, but is this specific world that we had before the internet. I think the advent of the information age and the internet has completely changed the way we interact and the possibilities of exploring the world. So I think that in a way, not having those tools was a great limitation. But through these limitations, as we said earlier, sometimes limitations imposed on you actually inspire creative solutions. I think you weren't exposed to so much information, but you had to be imaginative to make up what is missing. So this is something that I find missing a little bit. This world that had a great deal of mystery, if you like, that had a lot of shady corners. And perhaps I wouldn't have become a researcher, I think, if I had been bombarded with information during my teenage years. I think my teenage years were full of question marks, areas that I didn't know how they looked like, monuments that were completely unknown to me. There was simply no Wikipedia and no Google to actually give you a quick answer So you had no other option other than forging those skills that can get you a little bit closer to the truth. So I remember this exploration as something extremely fascinating, and the thrill of finding every bit of information that interested you was completely irreplaceable. Yeah. Now you have access to every musical piece you like, for instance, with those streaming engines. You can just click what you want. But I remember back then, an enormous aspect of the production of major composers was completely unknown to you, and you were trying to imagine what could this sound like.
You know, you've just made me think that back in those days, because of course it's easy now for us to draw that point of comparison, but back then I quite liked sometimes the arduous nature, the challenge that was needed. If you wanted to do something, and it applied to research, I would go physically to different university libraries around the country in search of a particular book. Almost laughable by today's standards, in the sense that there are far easier ways and cheaper ways of doing it. But actually the journey there was part of the whole effort. And I, that's why I still go to the cinema rather than, you know, it's easy just to be at home and press a button and there it is. But I remember it was around, I think, 1996, and I was keen to get hold of Hitchcock's North by Northwest, which was a film I'd liked. I'd only seen once or twice, and in those days, you really had to catch it on TV if you because it wasn't available for some reason on VHS at that particular period, or there were older copies. And I once went, and I think I tried through Empire magazine to try and track down a copy, and it would have been quite expensive. And I actually went to London especially to look for it, just go around different VHS, you know, video shops and so on. And I was out of luck, although I did find it. I think it was released on only a short period after that, and I got my copy. And I have multiple copies on DVD and Blu-ray and all the rest of it. But it's so interesting that the effort to track down and apprehend something that you really want, it makes a huge difference to doing that because it's worth the investment to simply pressing a button.
Absolutely.
And that's why even today I went to see North by Northwest at the BFI, and a colleague was saying, "Oh, why don't you just, you know, I've got a copy on my shelf here. Why don't you just watch it now on the TV?" And I was like, "That's not the point at all." And I know how crazy that sounds. But it's without that sort of effort. What's the point in trying it out? I don't want necessarily things to be easy. There's some things in life I wish were a bit easier than they are. But sometimes without those challenges, I think we kind of miss the wider picture.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's what I think many creators of the 19th century called, used a religious term, in fact, they called it pilgrimage, the pursuit of knowledge, not necessarily God. As far as they were concerned, even though for them artistic, true, and God, I'm thinking of Liszt in particular, Franz Liszt, the famous composer and great pianist, who actually composed a series of pieces entitled Année de Pèlerinage, which means Years of Pilgrimage, and that was a quest around Europe in search for inspiration that could be conveyed to music. I think what we did when we were looking for that film or we're looking for that book or for that piece of information in the library was some sort of pilgrimage. And what is interesting with the notion of pilgrimage is that it's not only about the destination, of course, in a medieval context was a holy relic, wasn't it? Or a hallowed spot. But I think it's more about it's also about the ritual, it's also about the path. It's about what you think during your pathway to the site of your destination. And I think you learn almost as much from the journey as you do from the actual destination, or even more so. And I was just talking with my wife about this, how important this pilgrimage must have been to mobilize Europe during the Middle Ages and to make cities actually correspond once again, sometimes a pretext. Religion or religious rituals can be also a pretext for other things, for getting people together, for having people, creating a dynamic that makes people travel, and then they can know themselves better or by meeting other people or being exposed to different landscapes. So I think that this pursuit of knowledge, active pursuit of knowledge, which is not offered to you, making you a passive recipient of it, but actually solicits some kind of active effort, in the form of moving around, traveling, for instance. I think that's incredibly creative. And if you ask me what you miss mostly, I don't know if it is the place that I've left behind, Athens, or whether it is the fact that at that time you actually had to travel to find knowledge and your curiosity was not satisfied through, you know, the internet, but it was satisfied through movement in space and discovery of wonderful spaces. And in my particular case, a wonderful city that Athens was, full of secrets, mysteries, but also full of opportunities for knowledge.
Absolutely. And I think that's why, for me, lockdown wasn't the most felicitous time in my life, shall we say, because it sort of, I saw that as a curtailment. Yes. But also, I had no difficulty kind of doing what we were told to do, because we all had to do it. We all had to do it together. I think the worst thing is if your freedoms are taken away, but you know that their life is carrying on around you, because we were all in the same boat, or so we thought. Obviously, things may have been going on in Downing Street about which we were blissfully unaware. But I think there is something about that sort of interplay between the journey, the destination, and how sometimes, and we have it with students, of course, that before they've even finished their degrees, everyone, of course, is always having to think ahead to the next stage, like we do. Yes. And filmmakers do that. We do with our books, or filmmakers do with their products. By the time the film comes out, there are already one, or in some cases, maybe two films further along. So there's that sense that, you reach one destination, and then that just becomes the starting point for the next, for the next stage of the journey.
Yes, 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 indeed. Absolutely. I know exactly what you say about the limitations that we have been facing, and again, what I thought that, you know, is actually reduces the scope for imagination and the availability of all this information, then at least in this situation, at least provided some relief to the fact that we were enclosed, that we had to be indoors. It became a means of escaping and discovering things. So actually, yes, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? On one hand, it might make you passive, but on the other hand, I must acknowledge that all this availability of information led us to discoveries that we could never have made otherwise.
Yeah. Well, and also the technology of it, because actually it's been terrific for my podcast, because I've interviewed people. You know, often I'd have people, I think, oh, I'd love to interview so-and-so, but they're in New Zealand or they're in Canada. I'm never, the chance is not going to happen. And of course, I've interviewed them. And it was, that's the one plus, that at least, I would have quite liked a journey to those places if I could afford it. But actually just doing it from my office here, I suppose, was probably the next best thing.
New opportunities arise, so there are in every, some avenues become closed down, others open. Yeah. So I like to see it optimistically at the end of the day.
And we must talk about radio as well, because that's the other twin, the passion that both of us have. And is radio also something that goes back to childhood?
Yes, absolutely. A great school for me, radio. In particular, the Greek equivalent of Radio 3 here, which is called Radio 3 in Greece. Trito programma, in particular. I say it in Greece because these sounds have a certain melody that goes with it. Now, yes, it was. I was very exposed to the radio since an early age, and I was very fortunate to listen to incredible broadcasts that again helped you travel and discover the world in a very, very beautiful way. So there was again music from all around the world included in the program. I remember a wonderful series of programs about the music of the Afro-American community and all the associated heritage. It was very well done. Mm. So documentaries, radio documentaries in a way, that were extremely well scripted. Other poetic broadcasts, but perhaps most relevant to our discussion today, there was quite a lot of time devoted to film music. And that was an introduction to film like no other, because you would listen to the music of a film, you would have a description of what the film was about, and that would actually generate curiosity to discover the film itself, but actually, it's to reflect on its messages and the role that music may have. And it was, I think, through my exposure to film music That I developed this passion for classical music, because I very soon found that most of the composers that made the best soundtracks were actually very accomplished classical composers that were using the instruments of the orchestra. And that's how it was through radio, speaking about cinema, through the lens of music, that my passion for music was triggered. And here, of course, we're very fortunate, I think, with Radio 3. And I think broadcasts like Composer of the Week or I think The Sound of Cinema is a really good one in Radio 3. I think they open an incredible window into history. You can travel in time through those broadcasts. They are delivered in such a passionate and informative way. I think we're very spoiled to have access to such wonderful, inspiring information. Yeah.
And you never know how you're going to use it or if it might be useful. There are things from childhood, like my parents, I think, sometimes despair, like, oh, he's listening to the radio again and again and again. But there are things that I learned, and even to this day, I can remember the context. And also, even if I'm like doing schoolwork or university work, having the radio on, I always joke about this, is the radio on in the background, or is, you know, which is in the background? Is it the work, you know, the essay or the radio? But the two would be a great sort of counterpart for one, or maybe a counterpoint to one another. And so even to this day, I can situate my knowledge of dates, or my grasp of dates and places and you know, keeping a diary and so on, it all fits with this, because I have the accompaniments, I have the musical memories and what I was listening to on the radio, who was a guest on a particular interview program or whatever at the time. So in themselves, you could say they might not be of huge significance, but it's what it does in terms of the wider context and the situating. And maybe there might be an interview with somebody you never heard of. Maybe that person 20 years later, suddenly that takes on a whole new meaning or significance, or somebody, they do something infamous or whatever. So suddenly you've got that, oh, you know, that I remember the original sort of encounter of that particular politician or comedian or actor or whatever it might be.
And in my case, I think those broadcasts back then were associated with the time of day. I always listened to the radio while working as well, as in the background. And I remember it provided incredible inspiration, but it also structured the day, because there was a different time for broadcasts of different content. So it provided, let's say, some color to, if I may use this metaphor, to the different parts of the day, but it also marked an era. And of course, I don't know how I would feel were I to listen to those broadcasts, those cherished voices again. Probably, I suspect it would be very, very moving. I remember actually recording many of those broadcasts during my teenage years in our little cassettes that we had, and I still have them. Perhaps I should give it a try and see how it feels to go back to them.
Well, I did exactly the same as you. Admitting mine's more sort of pop music, radio stuff, but I recorded from the beginning. Well, I've got stuff from when I was at school as well, but from going my first term at university, so 1991, for the next 14 years until, you know, a year or so after I moved to Kent, I would record stuff off the radio and I digitised them. And I now listen to them on a loop in my car. I think I've got 90 hours worth of material. Yes. And each one, I'm transported back to the time when I pressed that record button.
It was a magical experience, wasn't it? And also your ability to compile things, to create your own playlists, but they somehow feel different from these playlists that we have now.
But also, if you playlist now, sometimes can be very, almost very sort of sanitary. It's very sort of that song is on, then the next one. Yeah. But then I've got the radio voices, the presenters.
Exactly.
And some of those presenters have now died. Yes, some of them are no longer working, or maybe some of them, in very few cases, are still on. And I think it's that sort of context that matters, because it's a reminder that's what we did in those days, rather than our faulty memories of what we got up to in those long distant
years. And as you say, it's the curation that those good radio presenters made of a piece actually completely changed the piece. I remember there was one particular show on Greek Radio 3, which was called All the Mornings of the World. It was a paraphrase, actually not a paraphrase, it was the use of a title of a very, very good film, Tous les Matins du Monde, which depicted the life of a musician, Saint-Colombe. But it was a wonderful philosophical reflection on the day, as the presenter said, and he improvised in a very poetic way on a wider range of philosophical concepts. And he used music as an illustration of these ideas, or sometimes he created a counterpoint between an idea and the musical piece. And boy, did these pieces change through this association. They developed a magical aura, which made them unique. I think if you listen to them in any different setting, they are completely different. Yeah. So this person was not just a curator, was not just a presenter. This person was a creator.
As we start to wrap up, Nikos, I'm guessing the answer to this question is yes. But would you say that as you look back on your life and career, your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are, of course, many negative memories. But one, I'm an optimist, and I like to move forward with mainly positive. Yeah. Memories, because they have such a creative potential, and they can inspire you as you go forward.
And what comes out, and you've already, I think, addressed this, but even those negative things, I mean, COVID is a very obvious example, can be turned to positive gain in the sense that it did make us have to rethink, maybe press that reset button sometimes, the things we take for granted.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also to understand that things that we take for granted can be taken away, so it is very important to enjoy life and to use its opportunities to be creative, and as you say, you can see through adversity, your response to adversity can be creative and can generate the conditions for something positive.
What would your younger self, do you think, because it also depends, which younger self, 5, 10, 15, 20, think that you would have done with your life? Did you ever think what career you might have followed?
A different career than the actual one. I think that looking back, I think that I may have explored music. I think that was always an alternative career that I could have considered. I think that, but I've have such a strong connection with architecture. Architecture and research in associated topics has played such an important role in who I am that I find it difficult to picture myself in any other way, or actually try to go back into the shoes of my younger self and try to envision a different pathway. It is perhaps my mind is too full simply with reflections and thoughts and ideas associated with what I do to actually reconstruct an alternative pathway. So I don't think I can imagine myself doing many different things from what I'm doing now.
I always wonder if there was a time machine, or like, is it the DeLorean in the Back to the Future films, and I went back to the 80s or 90s, whatever it might be, would I just end up doing the same things all over again? and I wonder, because, you know, sometimes we think, God, I wish I hadn't done this, or hadn't met that person, or hadn't done this, or whatever it might be. But in some cases, we kind of all do the things that we're almost, I can't say programmed to do. I mean, I guess the free will and fate and predestination, all those sort of questions. But I do find it very interesting sometimes that no matter where I am, you know, we all sort of seek out the same sort of community of people. Yeah. That if we go to a different university, for example, to work, we end up, you know, meeting people with similar sort of mindsets. Yeah. We sort of would end up, maybe we would end up following the same path. Yeah. So if we may have taken a different route at a different stage to the one that we're in now, maybe we would have ended up at the same destination. We never know, and that's one of the great joys of life, has all these possibilities, we think, open to us.
Or maybe, you know, our response to accidents is actually what makes us who we are. For you mentioned North by Northwest, and it's a film that is all about this. For instance, if one might think that if Cary Grant didn't have this accident, unfortunate accident at the beginning of the film, he would have continued his humdrum live rhythms, which wouldn't be half as exciting as meeting Eva Mary Saint and indeed James Mason. What a wonderful role that was. And what a great actor. By the way, it was one of my favorites. And I think what this film shows is something actually that one of my favorite authors, Somerset Maugham, once remarked, that when adversity appears, of course, it's very badly received, but actually in many cases, this accident we're confronted with actually gives a completely new dimension to our life through our response to it. And always when we feel that we are being limited by things, perhaps we should always seek for this possibility to actually react, to actually carve a new pathway out of a situation. And by trying to find this pathway, we create incredible things, or we make fantastic discoveries.
Do you know, you just made me think of something here, because you're right, because in North by Northwest, he's this quite sort of capacious, empty, shallow advertising
exactly.
person, and a bit of a cad, you know.
Yes,
and,
yes.
But then he obviously does this incredible thing. He sacrifices himself for somebody else, which that's not the trajectory that he's on. He becomes
a murderer.
He's assumed to be a spy, then he has to take on that mantle in order to survive, and not just for him to survive, but also the woman who he's put at risk, Avery Marie Saint.
Yes.
So you've got that element. And I think that's why North by Northwest is such a clever film, because you see that character arc. And I think that's why I sometimes find, talking about spy films, James Bond, a bit less interesting sometimes.
Interesting.
Because there are some Bond films where it starts off, in a way he's not that necessarily that different at the end than he was at the beginning. Some of the Daniel Craig, they're all very good films, I suppose, in their own way. But sometimes you see him at the beginning on a great chase and he's doing all the spy things. And you think, but you haven't got the same arc. Some of the Bond films, actually, I think the last one, No Time to Die, did have that in spades. But isn't it interesting that we all need that kind of challenge sometimes? We don't want bad things to happen to us, but when they happen, and inevitably they will, then sometimes it's how we respond to those. I mean, it's the great theodicy question, that's at the heart of theology, but it is interesting that maybe both of us are drawn to films because they give us that template. Maybe in a different sort of scenario we would quite like to be Roger Thornhill.
Absolutely. Or even to see the same story from a different lens. I for some reason I'm always drawn to the ruthless character, I must confess, of James Mason in that film. I think it's because of the actor himself, who was so charismatic and almost seemed to, while being extremely natural in the way he played, he instilled some kind of sarcasm, or I think in the proceedings especially, or he was also capable of incredible gravitas. I remember him, for instance, in, was it a Disney production, to 20,000 Leagues Below the Sea, Jules Verne fairy tale of sorts, where he adds this incredible gravity in the proceedings. Again, another film with an accident, which shows you characters that are shown to you a little bit desiccated, or not, perhaps not the right word, stilted, you would say, a bit uninteresting, let's say, because they are typecast. You have Kirk Douglas as a sailor who is doing what an American sailor is expected to do, play the banjo and entertain other members of the crew. And then there is the researcher, and their life is completely changed when they find themselves in a submarine that they didn't know existed even as a device back then, and in the context of this bigger-than-life, larger-than-life character played by James Mason. And on one hand, of course, it's the accident. There are many tragic things that are happening, but you see them in an incredible learning curve and an incredible challenging situation, and it makes you feel that, like Mr. Thornhill, if this hadn't happened, perhaps they should have invented this accident.
And I think for research as well, we all need a counterpoint. Sometimes when ludicrous views are expressed on a certain topic, that's actually perfect, because it gives us something to engage with, something meaty with which to completely get caught up. And you're right about James Mason, The Verdict, the film against Paul Newman. I think, and that film, and
really
what works so well about that is it almost it works so slowly, and it's all the more suspense laden, because you sort of see this man. Of course, James Mason is kind of the villain. He's the lawyer in the piece in that case, but somebody who's completely washed out, somebody completely broken, and then actually he suddenly finds his path through his ambulance chasing. Is actually his path to redemption.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And I've got one more question
absolutely.
For you, Nikos. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, that's a huge question and a very good one. Someone had described, you know, the architect as someone like a person that looks both front and back, because you need to connect what you do with the past, because the places we create, of course, consist of older buildings and older concepts. So you have to understand this, but then again, you have to take these places to the future and manage their the way they change. So it's a luxury, perhaps, to say that I always look ahead, as it would be. I always look at the past. I think a balance there, if there was a median answer, if you would accept it, you know, something between the two. I must say that I'm through my research, I've sought to reconstruct lost buildings graphically. So to use my drawing skills and my understanding of research and archaeology and history of architecture in order to reconstruct lost buildings. And I find that this is a pathway towards recreating something that was lost, recapturing a lost dream, in the same way perhaps that the cinema tries to recreate the lost atmosphere of a distant point in time and a place in time. I very much like get incredible enjoyment out of this recreation or recapturing a lost world. So I think that makes me someone that looks back and tries to understand the past, but not to fetishize it, not only to get a better knowledge of what happened, but also to make it actual again, to help people experience it as if it was still around. So when I tried to make a perspective drawing showing the interior of a 6th century church, I feel that in a way it's as if I'm rebuilding this church now. And if one of the readers of my articles or if one of my students look at this perspective drawing and say, this space was actually is incredible, it has such a X quality to it, it sort of has this it's a sore towering space and it has this beautiful view towards the east part of the building, for instance, if they make remarks like that, it's as if they are experiencing this building today. So you've given a second life to this building. So I think there is an element of, a forward-looking element to this exercise of actually trying to recapture something lost in time.
So that is an amazingly considered answer. And I think, and the springboard for exactly why I think for the two of us, we're doing the job that we do while we're in this profession, that sort of notion of reflecting and actually using the past as a template for making sense of where we might go in the future, but while not neglecting the present at the same time. But Nikos, wonderful. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Well, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.